We saw that the rebellion of Absalom was quickly put to an end by... It's kind of interesting. God is mentioned so little in these chapters. In chapter 20, God is mentioned only in an oath type of setting. You have a lot of pragmatism going on. This works. This is what I want to do. We're going to do this. And you see this even with David. And one of the things that reflects that is the dominant character in this whole section here. The guy who makes things happen, the mover and shaker of all these chapters, is a guy named Joab. Joab is successful because success succeeds. He is a very, very capable guy. Now, we like to exalt wisdom. Wisdom is good. You take the facts, and wisdom is applying knowledge and putting it to work so that you get the outcome you want. That's the world's wisdom. That's how the world thinks. Godly wisdom is doing what God tells you to do. But you have a lot of worldly wisdom in this whole situation here. You've got Ahithophel and Hushai with their counsel. You have the wise woman who came at Joab's bidding and convinced David to bring Absalom back to Jerusalem. We're going to be looking at a wise woman here. We saw the wisdom of Joab, which politically speaking was wise. We can't capture Absalom, which was really odd because David says, be merciful to the young man and spare his life. And in the kind of war setting that they had here, that would be almost impossible. And yet the setting turned out to be a situation where they could have, but didn't. And we talked about this last time before, that if you were to capture Absalom, looking at this from a political perspective, what do you do with him? As long as that young man is alive, he is a danger. He is in rebellion against God's decreed will. David is God's anointed. If you read the parallel passages toward the end of David's life in 1 Chronicles, you find out that Solomon was and had been God's chosen to succeed David, which is one of the reasons why Absalom and Adonijah and some of these others are vying for the throne, because they know that my little brother over here, my much younger brother over here, is the one that the king is planning on having replace him, and I'm the oldest. I mean, obviously, I'm the one that should have this job. And so this should be mine instead of this young upstart over here. And so you have a lot of human wisdom. And it continues here in chapter 20. It says in verse 1, and there happened to be there a man of Belial. Now what does that mean? That's a figure of speech that we see in the Old Testament. What does that mean? Yeah, it's a term used for the devil. It was a foreign god, and it became synonymous for the devil. So basically what they're saying is that this guy here was a wicked man, an ungodly wicked man. This is not the assessment of David or Joab. This is a statement of the author of this book under inspiration, that this guy was a wicked guy. And his name was Sheba, the son of Bichri, a Benjamite. And he blew a trumpet and said, we have no part in David, neither have we inheritance in the son of Jesse. Every man to his tents, O Israel. Is he looking to replace David with himself? I don't think that's the primary thing here. We don't see this. I think what he's looking at is, remember, because we saw at the end of the previous chapter, there was a bit of a schism between Judah, which was the tribe that David was part of, and the rest of Israel. There was a little bit of a schism as far as bringing David back. And they both wanted David back, but there was some divided loyalties. And very much the country was still divided in regard to David. I mean, not a lot of time has passed between the defeat of Absalom and his great forces. I remember he stole the hearts of the children of Israel, so he had a huge following. And so there's still divided loyalties. And this guy, it mentions that he's a Benjamite. Why is that significant?
You're always causing trouble.
Well, sometimes, yes. Ephraim sometimes causes trouble too, but what's the significance of Benjamin besides being troublemakers for at least some times? Okay, Saul. Saul, the first king, David's predecessor, had been of the tribe of Benjamin. A source of great pride, a source of power, influence. Saul had promoted the Benjamites in positions and so on, and so this guy here is almost certainly going to be an advocate of the prior dynasty. And he's probably, there's some indications here, that he is related to that, to Saul's family, more than just on a tribal basis. Probably a second cousin or something of that nature. And so he's looking to have the nation split, to secede from a united Israel, which will happen here in another 45, 50 years, but have, but not the way he wants, but have Judah just do their own thing. They can have their King David if they want to, but we're gonna have our own nation here, and we're gonna, if he has his way, have a king of the tribe of Benjamin. And so he blows a trumpet. And so it says, and he got a following, at least initially, verse 2. And so every man of Israel went up from after David and followed Sheba, the son of Bichri, but the men of Judah clave unto their king from Jordan even to Jerusalem. So we have a divided loyalty. Prompted by this guy. Now, he's taking advantage of the circumstances. Remember, divided nation. And he is not at all happy with the circumstances. There's instability in the land, and so he's taking advantage of this. And so David came to his house at Jerusalem. So Sheba did this even before David arrived back to Jerusalem. He's on his way, and Sheba does this. Now, we have something mentioned just almost in passing. Remember, we've talked about this before. We don't sin in a vacuum. Our sin influences other people. We as believers, Nathan said that David's sin had given great cause for the enemies of God to blaspheme. You know, you hear about some preacher that's involved in some horrific scandal. And he might even be pastoring, you know, a church, the size of Grace. And something goes, well, that'll make the news. Have a businessman do some, something scandalous. Who cares? Or a president do something scandalous. Who cares? But, have some pastor, some little church out in the middle of nowhere do something and it makes the news. Because the world revels in that kind of thing. Revels in the scandals that might plague God's people. And they'll take note of it and broadcast it. And so one man's sin undermines and causes all kinds of havoc. I mentioned a friend of mine got killed in a snowmobile accident on Friday. That was one of the pieces of bad news I got. The other piece of bad news I got was that somebody I've known for over 20 years, he and his wife have split up, and evidently happened a number of months ago, and I hadn't known about it. And I'm thinking, and Bible college graduates, and I'm just thinking, yeah, what is the matter with you knuckleheads? You know better, and it's not a matter of cheating. It's a matter of self-will. You are determined to go back on your vows and do what you want at the expense of your relationship and of your testimony, and you don't care. You don't care. It's like, what's the matter with you? And we don't sit in a vacuum. It influences other people. This is going to cause heartache. This is going to cause trial and tribulation. This is going to undermine testimonies. This is going to affect people that they may have had a ministry with years ago. This thing is awful. Now, we see the snowball here. We see David's sin of years before. His adultery with Bathsheba. His murdering her husband to cover it up. And Nathan saying, you did this in secret. But the sword will never depart from your house, and God will bring judgment on you before all Israel. This is still going on. That was the source of Absalom's rebellion. This is also one of the reasons why David grieves so much, because he's looking at this big rebellion and thinking, it's all my fault, it's all my fault, it's all my fault. Now, Absalom is culpable. Absalom is responsible for Absalom. But at the same time, what David had done legitimizes somebody else's sin. Well, Dad did it, why can't I? And it gives excuse for wickedness. You know, this is one of the reasons why, you see this in Proverbs. If you have wickedness in leadership, then what are the underlings like? If we see all kinds of wickedness and debauchery at the head of our nation, lying and cheating and stealing and adultery and who knows what else is going on, what are the rest of people like? We only get a hint of the wickedness that goes on in Washington, D.C. The prostitution, the cheating, the adultery, all this debauchery and wickedness. Hedonism is the key word for our country these days. Let's pursue the lusts of the flesh to the hilt. Let's do what we please. Let's indulge ourselves. This is why you have the legalization of pot. If pot is a useful medicine, and I'm not necessarily denying that it isn't under certain circumstances, then process it and put it in a little capsule and make it a prescription drug. But no, we can't do that. We have to legalize it because the issue is not the drug. That's the argument. What they want is legalization for recreational use, and that's the key point. That's what they want. Why? Hedonism. That's why they want it. Sheba's revolt. The snowball effect of sin. David arrives back in Jerusalem. You may have innocent people that are going to suffer the consequences of somebody else's sin. And that's what you have in verse 3. David came to his house at Jerusalem, and the king took the 10 women, his concubines, that he had left to keep the house and put them in ward. What had happened to these 10 women that he had left there?
His son had taken them.
Yes, his son had taken them and had physical relations with them to finalize the schism between father and son and also lay claim to the throne by taking over his father's harem. Well, David comes back. He can't restore, because of the circumstances, he can't pretend that this didn't happen. He can't go back and just resume relationships with these ladies. And yet he can't punish. I mean, they didn't do anything. It was against their will. There was nothing they could do. They were stuck. And so he put them in ward and fed them, but he went not in unto them. So they were shut up unto the day of their death, living in widowhood. He provided for them. Their needs were met. But there's no relationship with David. The consequences of sin, not their own doing, the consequences of other people's sin. Now, we've got Sheba who had blown the trumpet. We've got the everything in an uproar. What needs to be done quickly. And the king said to Amasa, assemble me the men of Judah within 3 days and be thou here present. Okay. You got 3 days to gather up all the troops. Remember, they just come off of something, so it shouldn't take that long to get the job done. Gather the troops, meet me here in Jerusalem, and then we got to deal with Sheba. Now, who's Amasa? We saw this last time. Amasa is David's nephew. Amasa is the son of David's other sister. He had two sisters, older sisters, Abigail and Zeruiah. Zeruiah is the mother of Joab and Abishai. And Amasa is the son of his sister Abigail. When Absalom seized the throne, Joab is with David. Joab's loyal to David. Here's Joab. Joab is a pragmatist. Joab is completely loyal to David, and he is totally unsubmissive. Churches are filled with people like this. Oh, I'm loyal to Jesus, but I'm not going to submit to him. That's Joab. Who does Absalom have as the commander of his army? Amasa. Amasa is Absalom's commander. And David, in the aftermath of the Civil War, to try to bridge things and bring some harmony there, gives Joab the boot and puts Amasa into his place, which, as we're going to see here, was a very dangerous thing to do, not so much for David, but for Amasa. So Amasa is sent to go take care of these things. He's going to muster the troops and so on. And Amasa either has the slows or he's incompetent or whatever the case may be. But it says there that, verse 5, so Amasa went to assemble the men of Judah, but he tarried longer than the set time which he had appointed him.
What does that mean?
That means that David had told Amasa, you get the troops together and be back here in Jerusalem in 3 days so we can deal with this. Well, 3 days come, where's Amasa? Where are the troops?
That was deliberate?
Doesn't say. Might just be incompetence. We don't know. Doesn't say. But the fact is that Amasa was not back in time at the stipulated time. He didn't fulfill his orders. And as a matter of fact, we're going to see a little bit later on, I don't think he was even close to fulfilling his orders. So, what do? We've got to deal with Sheba. David's sitting here in Jerusalem saying, where is this guy? He's supposed to be here. We need to deal with this. And so, plan B. Now remember, Joab's out. I think David had been looking for an opportunity to deal with Joab. Remember, Joab had murdered Abner. Joab is often insubordinate. Joab had killed Absalom, which politically speaking was an extremely expedient thing to do, but it was against the express orders of David. So Joab is out. And I think David is finally, this rascal, he's good. He's good at what he does. I mean, no one is better than Joab at this kind of thing. As leading the army and success in the battlefield. No one's better, but good grief, I gotta deal with the repercussions, what this guy does, the extra stuff, and now he's no longer in charge, and you can see David just going, I'm glad he's done with. He's still around, but he's not in charge. Well, that's what we think. So plan B. David said to Abishai, now remember, who's Abishai? He's Joab's brother. And he had been sort of second in charge of the military. Had been for a long time. And so David said to Abishai, now shall Sheba the son of Bichri do us more harm than did Absalom. If the longer we wait, the bigger this problem is going to get. Take thou thy lords, referring to David's servants, and pursue after him, lest he get him into one of the fenced cities and escape us, until he get into a defense city, a fortress of some sort, and escape us. And so there went out after him, after Abishai, Joab's men. The old guard. The old soldiers who are the best of the best, but they are Joab's men. They've been following Joab for decades. And these are the Cherethites and the Pelethites and all the mighty men. And they went out of Jerusalem to pursue after Sheba, the son of Bichri. Not necessarily a big army of men. These would be the same guys that fled with David when Absalom was coming. Loyal, very, very capable soldiers. A few hundred men. And so out they go. And they're heading north. It says, when they came to the great stone which is in Gibeon. This is 6-7 miles north of Jerusalem, not real far. They're on their way north in pursuit of Sheba. Amasa went before them. Oh, here he comes. He's on his way. He'd have been at Jerusalem later that afternoon. Amasa went before them, and Joab's garment that he had was girded about him. He's got his soldier's outfit and everything on. And upon it, a girdle. Now, what is a girdle in your King James Bible? A belt. So Joab has a belt, and he had a sword fastened on the belt. And when he went forth, it fell out. He bent down or something, and the sword fell out of the sheath onto the ground. Not by chance. Not by chance. Not with Joab, please. This guy's been a soldier this long, and his sword's just going to fall out on the ground. No. And Joab said to Amasa, now these guys are first cousins. Keep that in mind. Joab and Amasa are first cousins. And Joab said to Amasa, "Art thou in health, my brother?" Standard greeting. And Joab took Amasa by the beard with his right hand to kiss him. Now, you think, that's awful. Par for the course, standard operating procedure in the day. All right. You know, cultures. My wife was a little taken back. I have relatives in Quebec. And although they have an English background, my cousin Jonathan is married to a Quebecois. And they speak French in his home, and he is much more comfortable with French than he is with English, and he is a thorough Francophile. And he has a great ministry up there. And so he greets my wife, and he goes, grabs her by the shoulders, and mwah, mwah, and Aaron's just... All right. We're much more likely to do this kind of thing. If I were to grab him by the beard and kiss his cheek... All right, so you get the point. But for that was and these guys had known each other for all their lives. But he takes his right hand. Now, long ancient history, why do we shake with the right hand? To show there's no weapon. And so Joab is showing, I have no weapon. Now, what had he done? He picked up his sword with his left hand. And so Amasa is totally unsuspecting. And so he gives him a kiss on the cheek, and while he's kissing him on the cheek, what's he do?
Kills him.
Verse 10. Amasa took no heed to the sword that was in Joab's left hand. Unsuspecting. And he smote him therewith in the fifth rib. And shot out his bowels to the ground and struck him not again. Joab knew what he was doing. Killed the guy with one blow. Sort of a Harry Carey on the other guy. And he died. Surprise, surprise. And so, now it's Joab and Abishai, his brother, pursuing after Sheba, the son of Bichri. So Joab has removed his rival. Now we'll have to see the outcome. And one of Joab's men, because the men are still loyal to Joab, stood by him and said, "He that is favor of Joab and that is after David." So if you're going to be loyal to David, you're also going to be loyal to Joab. You know, they're a team. Let's go after Joab. And Amasa wallowed in blood in the midst of the highway. So when he killed him, he's laying right there in the middle of the road. And as the troops are going by, there's this dead guy lying there in the middle of the road. And when the man saw that the people stood still because they're stopping to look at Amasa, they took Amasa, grabbed him by the ankle or whatever, dragged him off out in the field and threw a rug or something over him. And cast a cloth upon him, and when they saw that everybody stood still, and when they had removed him out of the highway, all the people went after Joab and pursued after Sheba, the son of Bichri. Don't even bother burying the guy. We're just going to drag him out in the field, get him out of the way, and then we'll go about our business. So, they're going to pursue Sheba, the son of Bichri. And he went through all the tribes of Israel unto Abel. Where is Abel? If you read if you go through your Old Testament a number of different times, you'll see a figure of speech, Dan even to Beersheba. What does that mean? From Dan to Beersheba. North and south. Beersheba was the last town that you came to as you headed south. It was a little oasis in the desert. And Dan is way north of the Sea of Galilee. It's as far north as you could go in Israel and still have Israelites. West of Dan, just a little ways, is the town of Abel. Way, way, way to the north. Extreme north of Israel. This is where Abel is. And this is where Sheba had fled to. Which seems to indicate that Sheba didn't get the following that he had hoped. And that he's running for his life, and he maybe may have a few allies with him, but by and large, he's on his own. So he comes to, and it says, and all the Beerites, so his family, his little piece of his clan, are, maybe he's got a few dozen people, who knows, but he doesn't have a lot of people, just some relatives. And they gathered together and they went after him as well. And he came, they came, this would be Abishai and Joab, came and besieged the city of Abel. And it stood in the trench, and all the people that were with Joab, and they were battering the wall to throw it down. We've got him boxed into a city that has walls he can't escape, and we're going to get this guy. And so the city's under siege, and we're after this guy. But the problem is the people inside don't know what's going on. Joab and Abishai and his crew know that Sheba's in there, and the people in the town of Abel are like, we're under siege. And it's Israel's army that's attacking us, and what in the world is going on? Why are we under attack? And there cried out, verse 16, a wise woman. Now remember, most of the time in the scripture, wise carries with it the idea of godly. We see this in Proverbs all the time. But wise can also be, well, you got this, and you got this, and you got this. This is what needs to be done if we're going to have a positive outcome. Now, in this particular case, she is not in the wrong. Remember, Sheba is a son of Belial. He's a son of Bichri, but he's a son of Belial, which means he's a wicked man. David is the man of God's choosing to reign over the nation Israel. Someone who rebels against God's appointment in that particular way is in rebellion against God. And so there's a wise woman who is in the city, and she takes things into her own hands to some extent. And she cried out and said, I pray you, come hither that I may speak unto you. He says, are you Joab? Yes, I'm Joab. And then she gives this little speech. The prelude is almost funny. She's talking about, you know, we have a great chamber of commerce here and just a wonderful place out here. The scenery is really nice here in Abel. And why are you here? Why are you bothering us? You know, we've had things really nice up here, and then you show up and you're ruining everything. What in the world is going on? And she says, you know, they used to ask counsel at Abel, and so that ended the matter. It says, I am one of those, verse 19, that are peaceable and faithful in Israel. Now seekest destroy a city and a mother in Israel. Why wilt thou swallow up the inheritance, Lord? Why are you here? Why are you attacking our city? Why are you trying to destroy us? Now remember, Joab, you watch Joab how he operates. Joab, for his fellow Israelites, is jealous of life. He may wipe out the Edomites and the Ammonites and the Syrians and so on in war and so on. But when it comes to his fellow Israelites, he is not going to shed blood unnecessarily, except for the guy who's his own personal rival. But he's not going to wipe out a city. He's not going to deal with thousands and thousands of people if he can deal with the one. If I kill Absalom hanging in the tree and then I immediately blow the trumpet, that ends the conflict and we're done killing each other. And we see this a couple of other times with Joab. And so he says, hey, I'm not here to destroy. I'm not here to, far, it says, far be it from me that I should swallow up or destroy. The matter is not, but a man from Mount Ephraim, Sheba the son of Bichri by name, hath lifted up his hand against the king, even David. Deliver him only, and I will depart from the city. You give us the rebel, we're gone. Because that's the only reason I'm here. And the woman said, behold, his head shall be thrown to thee over the wall. Now, does she talk to anybody before she tells Joab this? No. But she's a sharp enough character to know it's a done deal. Just take my word for it. And so the woman went unto her people in her wisdom, and they cut off the head of the head of Sheba, the son of Bichri, and cast it out to Joab. Here you go! Now, that sounds kind of gruesome and gory, but frankly, how else are you going to prove that you got this guy and he's dead? I mean, you can throw the whole body out there, I suppose. A lot easier just to throw the head. And as soon as he picked it up and said, yeah, that's him, he He blew a trumpet and retired from the city. Okay, we're done. Bye. And heads back to Jerusalem. Okay, so the rebellion is over. Now remember, God isn't... The only place where God is mentioned is where the woman says, "Why wilt thou swallow up the inheritance of the Lord?" That's the only place where this is where God is mentioned in this whole chapter. So, do things go back to relative normalcy after all this? Yeah, they do. Things have been shaky. There's been a lot of heartache. There's been a lot of bloodshed. But do things go back to normal? Yes, things go back to normal. How do we know? Because of these last few verses, your last four verses. Because it goes back and it just mentions David's cabinet again. Who's there? Who's in charge? And notice who the first one is. Now Joab was over all the host of Israel. Joab? He's killed Abner, Absalom, and Amasa. The triple A's. And he's still in charge. Did David want these three guys killed? No. But you know, human wisdom, being pragmatic, Joab was far better than Abner. Certainly dealt with Absalom after his... And Amasa was demonstrating his incompetence. Success succeeds. David's thinking, you know, he's a rascal, but he is the best of the best. And so I'll tolerate it. Is that right and good? No. But he tolerates it. After all, remember, it's his nephew. For good or bad. And it mentions Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, that'll come into play later on, who's over the Cherethites and the Pelethites, and mentions the rest of the officers. So we have a return to some extent of normalcy and stability. And for the most part, we'll see that up through the end of David's reign. Now, what's the chief lesson that we see? The snowball of sin. All this stuff that's gone on goes back to David's lusting after a woman, fulfilling his lust, and then sinning again to cover it up. And all of this is the result of that. The snowball of sin. And remember, sin makes us stupid. I'll guarantee you that as David is peering over the wall at Bathsheba and planning on what he's going to do, none of this crossed his mind. The implications of what he did not cross his mind. The consequences of, well, if I do this, then this is going to happen, or this might happen, or, you know, nobody thinks about that. They're tempted, they indulge, and then they make excuse and pretend it didn't happen. But sin has consequences. For the lost, sin has eternal consequences. For God's children, there are temporal consequences. And we don't sin in a vacuum. Our sin affects other people. We need to strive to be a holy people for a bunch of reasons. And this is one of them. That sin has consequences and it doesn't affect just ourselves. Heavenly Father, thank you for your word. Thank you for the warnings. Thank you for the lessons that we can learn, Lord, from the mistakes of others, from the wickedness of others. But Father, we sometimes have to learn on our own, and I pray that you would deliver us from such things. Father, may we learn from the wickedness of others. Learn what not to do. Father, may we heed this, we pray for Christ's sake. Amen.